You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm humbled by what has happened, and I renew my wholehearted apology for the gathering in the Cabinet room on the 19th of June, 2020.
I can't say whether he'll be Prime Minister going into 2023, but I don't think that he will lead the party into the next general election.
Why does the Prime Minister think everybody else's actions have consequences except his own?
You're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
And good afternoon, I'm Caroline Hepke. Coming up on today's programme, we speak to the Liberal Democrat transport spokesperson Sarah Olney as unions line up to announce plans for a summer of strike action.
And later in the show, we'll be digging into the latest population trends from the last 10 years. We'll discuss the census with the Office for National Statistics.
But first, the Prime Minister is at the NATO summit in Madrid, where he's pushing for Britain's allies to raise their target for defence spending. Boris Johnson wants the alliance to increase its official goal to at least 2% of GDP. That's as NATO faces growing security challenges after Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Well, the Met Police has been placed into special measures by Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary. London's force has been hit by a series of scandals, including the murder of Sarah Everard.
And as Russia's war on Ukraine threatens to deepen Europe's energy crisis, the UK has appointed a czar to ensure that it can keep the lights on this winter. The business department says energy security is an absolute priority.
Well, let's discuss today's big issues with our first guest, Lib Dem transport spokesperson and Member of Parliament for Richmond Park in London, Sarah Olney. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us on Bloomberg Westminster. Now, the worst rail strikes in decades last week. Do you think that the government is at fault here? And how would you resolve the situation?
Hi, hello there. Yeah, well, I mean, I really do, actually. I mean, I tabled a parliamentary question to ask the Secretary of State for Transport, Grant Shapps, just how many meetings he'd had with the union in the month leading up to the rail strikes, and the answer was none. And I think, you know, there's some debate about what role the government has when, you know, in the fine detail of the negotiation, but it seems clear to me that what's happening here is that the Secretary of State just wants to wash his hands of all responsibility for the strikes, and I don't think that's acceptable. It's a major part of our transport infrastructure, and the idea that he's had no role at all in trying to resolve the dispute suggests to me that what the Conservatives are trying to do here is very much weaponize these strikes as a way of attacking Labour. And frankly, I think that's letting down businesses, passengers, school children trying to get to their exams, all sorts of people who might be using the rail service for urgent appointments and meetings. And I think it's really disgraceful, actually. He should be getting involved and doing what he can to keep our trains running.
Okay, but the government isn't actually the employer of these rail workers. And, you know, rail workers want something like a 7% pay increase. But there are now a lot of other unions who are asking for, frankly, the impossible. I mean, doctors, the BMA, want like a 30% raise. That's not going to be feasible.
Well, I think so. Firstly, on the rail employers, so much of what they do is determined by the government. The government, I think, absolutely have a role in terms of empowering the employers and what they're able to offer. And I think it's important to understand that with the rail dispute, there are kind of two halves to it. Yes, there's a pay dispute, but there's also an ongoing negotiation about changes to the way that the trains are operated. And it is really important that we modernise our rail network, that we make it suitable for the future, and also that we need to look about how demand patterns may have changed as a result of the pandemic. So there's quite a lot of different issues going on with the rail dispute, and it wasn't just about pay. But I think more broadly, I think the government's approach to public sector pay has basically been to say to people, no, you're not having, you know, don't ask for a pay rise. But that at the time, when we're facing 11% inflation, I don't think that's sustainable. If they're not going to be offering anything at all on pay, then they need to do a great deal more to help individual households and families to meet the cost of living crisis. Now, what Liberal Democrats are asking for, we think they should reverse the national insurance hike that they brought in April. We think that they should be reducing VAT on all goods from 20% to 17.5%. We think that could put £600 back in the pockets of ordinary households. We think if they could do an awful lot more to be addressing the cost of living crisis for households, and we think that would lessen the pressure on household budgets.
Surely the government isn't going to concede 8 or 10% for rail workers at the beginning of all these pay negotiations. Surely they need to keep a lid on settlements for other negotiations later on in the year. Otherwise, the government will end up spending a fortune on public sector pay.
Well, I don't know specifically what the government are going to do about that, but I do think that they need to have a much more constructive attitude towards some of these pay settlements. As I say, I think they've just been weaponizing this rail strike to attack Labour, and they need to come to the table with all of the unions in a much more constructive frame of mind, because I do think that the cost, otherwise what they're asking is for households and individuals to take the hit on inflation, and that's going to reduce discretionary spend in households, and that will have an impact across our economy. So they need to think very hard about how as a government they want to really approach inflation and the cost of living, and what their strategy is.
But in some senses, that's the whole point, isn't it? To try to cool the economy. I mean, the Bank of England has already admitted that there are going to be tens of thousands of job losses, and that is basically necessary in order to bring inflation down, to try to cool, the economy. I suppose how to better handle this. This is an issue that is affecting everybody globally. It could get a lot worse if we end up with oil and gas caps or even energy cuts by Russia that will directly affect the UK.
Yeah, I mean, as far as the Liberal Democrats are concerned, some of the answers to the oil and gas issue are just to be investing more in renewables, and we've been calling for that for a very long time, and that would immediately boost the green economy. That's a route to economic growth, which actually is at the heart of our problems here. The government doesn't got a strategy for economic growth, and that's something that that's the kind of like the big issue that they really do need to address. But I'm not going to pretend that there's any obvious solutions here, but what we haven't got is a government that's really taking this seriously and thinking about how to act in the best interests of the country as a whole rather than the narrow interests of the Conservative Party.
Do you think that London is served by the Metropolitan Police, is well served by the Metropolitan Police? Were you surprised to hear that the Met's been put into special measures?
I work incredibly well with our local police forces in South West London, and I am full of admiration for the great work that they do keeping our streets safe. But I have got... I've had very severe concerns about some of the governance, some of the processes, perhaps some of the disciplinary measures with it. Both of the events that have happened, and obviously Sarah Everard is the one that's at front of everybody's mind, but we know there have been a string of others. The way that the police have responded to those, and some of the evidence that has been revealed about practices and processes within the Metropolitan Police, it does make people feel anxious. It does make people feel concerned. I was surprised, I think, to hear about the special measures yesterday, but I think if that's the catalyst to getting the Metropolitan Police leadership, and obviously we're waiting to appoint a new commissioner, that's the catalyst to get them to really look at these issues, then I think that will be a positive move.
What sort of Met Chief do we need? Does it have to be a woman? Does it have to be somebody from a diverse background?
I don't think we necessarily want to stick either of those things as must-haves. I think it needs to be somebody who's, I think it has to be somebody who's widely respected within the force, so that they can bring the metropolitan, the rank and file with them. But equally, it's got to be somebody who enjoys the confidence of both the mayor and the Home Secretary, and someone who's committed to addressing some of these issues. Because I think the clear requirement at this stage is to win back public trust, because that, I think, is the key issue.
A pretty impressive win for your party in Tiverton and Honiton. Do you think that Boris Johnson is going anywhere in the coming months? And for your party, aren't you rather pleased that he's staying around?
I mean, there's no doubt that the massive win we saw in Tiverton and Honiton last week was very much driven by, and I was down there several times myself, so I know this to be the case, that by public disillusionment with Boris Johnson and his government. I think anybody else would have resigned months ago if they'd had, you know, anyone else with any honour or integrity or a commitment to doing what's in the best interests of the country. So we are continuing our call for Boris Johnson to step down, because he's just an absolute disgrace as a prime minister. But there's no doubt that, as I say, that disillusionment drove people to come vote for the Liberal Democrats who might otherwise not have done so. But I think Richard Ford, the new MP for Tiverton and Honiton, he's a really fantastic guy. He's going to be a great MP, and I very much hope that people will see that, you know, when you elect a Liberal Democrat MP, you get somebody who works really hard for you and who sticks up for your best interests, and that they will be encouraged to vote Liberal Democrat more widely next time.
Yeah, and that's, I suppose, the kind of follow-up question. Does the kind of local, the one-off, the very individual campaign that you can run in that kind of by-election translate into something bigger? I mean, we were speaking to your former leader, Vince Cable, only just couple of days after, actually, the win. I mean, how do you translate it into a general election? I suppose you're all thinking about that pretty hard now.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're asking someone who won a by-election and then went on to win a general election. Perhaps not immediately afterwards, but I did in the future. So, you know, it absolutely
so
can.
You have the
I think
key.
Obviously, yeah, come and ask me about that. I think we're very focused on the next general election. We are focused on the seats where we know we can win. We're already working very hard where we think we can win. We've selected candidates, so we're focusing very hard on those seats. Obviously, we're going to be presenting a broad-based manifesto. We would really want to see support for that manifesto from right around the country. But we'll be working very hard in particular seats, and hoping to increase our parliamentary representation.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
And now to population growth in England and Wales. The latest data shows that it has slowed in the past decade, whilst the proportion of older people has continued to rise. According to the first results of the nationwide census, the pace of growth in the population eased to 6.3% since 2011.
That was down from 7.8% in the previous decade. The total population in England and Wales hit a record 59.6 million people, with migration accounting for 2 million of the 3.5 million increase over that 10-year period. Well, let's get more on the census with Becky Tinsley, Deputy Director of Social Statistics Transformation and Research at the ONS. Becky, thanks so much for joining us on the programme today. Just talk us through those headline numbers, especially the changing age demographics of England and Wales.
Hi, thanks for having me today. So the results that we released yesterday begin to paint a picture of the nation and how we were living during the pandemic. So as you mentioned, we hit a record 59.6 million, an increase of 6.3% since 2011. And what we've seen since we started the census in 1801 is that population continues to rise. There was only one decade where we saw a decline, and that was in the 70s. And as you said, we're an ageing population, so now more than one in six of us are pensioners. And for the first time, the population of age 90 plus reached more than 500,000. And that's the first time that we've seen those sorts of numbers coming out of a census. And of course, there's lots of regional and local variation of that picture.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one in five of us over the age of 65, you know, and this really rams home the reason that the census is so important, because, you know, all of the services and what people need is going to change so much based on this. As you say, though, big regional differences, certainly between Wales and England, between the southeast and London and other regions. Tell us about those differences.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. So the east of England was our fastest growing region, so that increased by over 8% since 2011. The southeast was the biggest region, so that hit over 9 million for the first time recorded through censuses. And then when you take a look at some of the more local patterns in terms of those age groups, we see in places like North Norfolk and Rother, one in three of those populations are pensioners, and East Devon had the highest proportion of 90-plus population. But then other parts of the country see a younger population. So in Barking and Dagenham, Slough, Luton, one in five of their population were children. So there are lots of variation, and you're absolutely right, the importance of census and having these numbers to inform all of the local and national services that we all rely on every day, and making sure that those services are being provided in the right place for the right people.
Yeah, really big regional split, just looking at the numbers. So growth of 7 or 8% across really London and the South East and the Midlands, but much, much slower in Wales and in the North East, a growth of less than 2% over the past 10 years, mm-hmm. and relatively slow in Yorkshire. Just talk us through some of the differences in growth at the local level, because there's some places which have shown lots and lots of growth in population, as much as 20%.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. So Tower Hamlets and Dartford saw an increase of about 20%. And then at the other end of the spectrum, places like Kensington and Chelsea and Westminster saw the largest decreases in population. So it is a really variable picture.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I live in Camden. There's an issue of closing schools because the population has changed so radically, the makeup of the population in that part of London. Some very stark differences in terms of the areas. Also pretty challenging to organise the census during the pandemic. How confident are you that the results are accurate?
Yeah, so we're really confident. We had an absolutely fantastic response from the public. So massive thank you to everyone that filled out their census forms. So we had over a 97% response rate. And for the first time, we engaged with more local authorities than ever before as part of our quality assurance process. So we're really confident in these the figures that we released yesterday.
And that's despite the pandemic, is it? Because it must have been incredibly challenging to organise this, you know, during a pandemic. I remember the people coming to my door. You're pretty clear. You're pretty sure that you've ironed out those issues, are you?
Yeah, absolutely. So the operation that we led, we had to make some changes to be able to do that during the pandemic. But actually, like I said, we had an amazing public response. And that might in part have been because people were at home and more able to respond. So that's fantastic. And then we go through a really, really rigorous process to process and quality assure all of those numbers, compare them with other sources, and before we actually release them. Which we did yesterday.
Okay. Are there also, of course, still more women than men in the population? And there are going to be a host more kind of statistics and revelations that you're going to bring out, but they're coming out in stages. So what more can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So yesterday we released the age and sex profile, and then from the autumn we start our next phase of releases, which looks at more topic-based information. So things like ethnicity and religion. For the first time last year, we asked questions on gender identity, sexual orientation, veterans, and those sorts of numbers will start coming out in the autumn. And over the next 2 years, we'll have released up to 5 billion statistics from the census. So absolutely masses of information yet to come.
5 billion, gosh, that's quite a lot of numbers. Now, the first census was in 1801, and I read on your website that 1841 was considered to be the first modern census. But there's been a fair bit of debate, hasn't there, about whether the census is really kind of fit for purpose in the 21st century. What bring us up to date with that discussion?
Yeah, so census continues to evolve. So last year we had a massive online response. 89% of people responded online. So that's sort of a more digital census. But of course, it's absolutely right that we continue to look at different ways of providing that sort of information. The information that comes out of census is vitally important. And alongside conducting the census, we're also doing research into how we can use other sources of information to be able to provide the information, but more frequently and more timely than we get from the current census. And we make a recommendation next year about what the future looks like, and you'll be hearing more about that work in the coming months.
Yes, I was going to ask you, because there was quite a lot of talk about this being the last ever census. Can you shed any light on that?
Yeah, so we've got a raft of evidence coming out in the next 6 months showing the research that we've used, using more administrative data, so things like records of information that are already held, so things like GP registrations and tax and benefits information. We'll be publishing that evidence, and that all then culminates in a recommendation that we will make towards the end of next year. There'll be a public consultation, so people will be able to get involved in that as well.
Yeah, because, of course, the statistics are pretty important when it comes to the government's levelling up agenda, when it comes to migration, about which there are there's obviously a great deal of debate. I mean, the idea that there are now more over 65s than there are kind of under 15s, that surely does, that should be a clear indicator in terms of the kind of needs economically of Britain.
Absolutely. These statistics are vital for informing policy making and decision making across the nation, and actually being able to shed more information more quickly and more frequently than before for some of those things, because we are an ever changing population, is really important.
Can you comment on the couple of boroughs in London, I think Westminster and Camden, right in the centre of London? Caroline mentioned this a bit early on, which registered a drop in population, quite a big drop in population. Can we be sure that those reflect the normal population, and that wasn't just something to do with people being away during the pandemic period? I read that there are concerns that people were moving to their second homes while the census was on, and now they've come back. And of course, this has big implications for the funding of those local authorities.
Yeah, so So the census is a snapshot of the population. So it gives us a fantastic opportunity to look at what the population was doing in March last year during a pandemic. And of course, the job for us now is to be able to show the change that has happened since that time. Change continues to happen. So people will continue to move house, people move in and out of the country, babies are born, people die. And it's now up to us to then show what that change has looked like since then. And so we've been working with local authorities and we'll continue to do so as we start to transform the way that we produce our population and migration statistics.
And the other, I mean, having talked about sort of population decline, I mean, the one thing to point out is that population density has gone up. It's obviously the highest in London, but it's pretty staggering. It's 14 times higher in London than it is across England and Wales. So London and the South East remain the big hub for the population.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, there's some fantastic interactive games and maps and things that people can go onto the ons.gov.uk website to actually look at what that population density looks like compared to the size of a football pitch. And that does, again, have lots of regional and local variation.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit returns to London on April 25th for a solutions-driven look at the sustainable business and finance landscape, looking at the latest trends in ESG regulations, supply chain innovation and transition finance. Speakers include leaders from CDP, Emirates Environment Group, Seedtrace, COA and more. Summit advisors include City Commercial Bank, Red Sea Global and Schneider Electric. Visit bloomberglive.com/sbs2024 to learn more.